So to avoid a little bit of the confusion, when I'm talking about everything is, you know, our fault, I don't necessarily mean it's my fault. I'm not up here to apologize for System D or anything along those lines. This is your fault. So a little bit of a disclaimer for this talk, because I was told there was a code of conduct, so let's go over a few things. This talk will probably cause sudden outbursts of profanity, either from me or from you. That is completely fine. If you're not okay with that, I'm sorry.
Just remember one thing.
Yes.
It's being recorded. It helps with post-production. We can use the Battle Star Galactica terms instead of...
Fair enough. Audience participation is encouraged. If I'm saying something that you feel is inappropriate, please feel free to step up and heckle me. I have no problem with that. Most likely, as a speaker, I will be heckling you. This talk will probably increase your blood pressure. There is some stuff in here that just makes you wonder what people were thinking. Along those lines, it may also decrease your faith in humanity. This event is BYOB. This is not water. I hope you brought enough to share. So, a little bit about me. Currently, I work for Red Hat, so that doesn't in and of itself say evil. We're good with this. We like to try to be the example to set for folks, and I'm okay with that. But where I get my perspective on evil is I've been a sysadmin now since, you know, the very late 90s. My Linux experience is old enough to drink. It's almost old enough to drink and drive, so we're doing this reasonably well. I joined the CentOS project around 2004, so we've got about 12 years under the hood of watching everyone else do terrible things with our software and trying to kind of steer them in the right direction as much as possible. Because I was not a Red Hat employee at the time when I started working for CentOS, I had to supplement my income and find ways to pay for my evil ideas and terrible things that we were doing. The first way that I started to do this was as an education industry professional, and that was fine, but that really wasn't quite what I wanted to do. So I moved from there into defense consulting, because that's your first real taste of doing terrible things. But after a few years of defense consulting, you realize it's the lowest bidder. Wait a second, if I want these contracts, I have to be the lowest bidder. That doesn't work out quite so well. The whole contract changed. So let's move into oil, because if I'm selling my soul, I want a good price for it. So to go about this correctly, we need to go back and we need to look at how people usually start out in the industry. So as a sysadmin or as a developer, as you know, your first big project, when they kind of take the training wheels off and say, hey, we want you to do this, everybody has that first thing, that first little ideological method, and they know the right way to do things. Maybe it's you're fresh out of school. Maybe it's you're coming into how we want you have kind of an idea for how you want things to look for your first project and how it needs to be done. Often when you talk to people, say, why are you doing it that way? Well, you find out usually there's reasons and it has nothing to do with tech. So the first time you're given a project for yourself, you want to build something amazing. You want to build something that's going to last. You want to do it right. Everyone who sees this thing needs to be impressed by it. Everyone wants to build their castle. So you start speccing it out, you look at your requirements, you figure out what you're doing, you get kind of an idea for what it's going to take to accomplish this. You look at the tooling that you've got, and you kind of start giving a rough diagram. You wireframe out your project. And then your management talks to you. You start to get an idea for, hey, wait a second, I don't have 6 months to do this project, I have 2 weeks. I don't necessarily have the right skill set for this. I may need to learn a different language. I may need to do something else. I may not have the right hardware or the right funding to get what I need to do done. So, all right, fine. Let's take a look at our options for our shiny new project. We can either continue with the original plan, and maybe we get halfway through finishing. Maybe we start to do it right, and by the time they see what we've started to accomplish, we'll be able to talk management into those new resources. We'll be able to talk management into what we think the vision should be. often that's not the case. Who here, show of hands, has seen an abandoned project at work? Something that's half done, half baked, just kind of sitting, Yeah, everybody's got one of those things on the left there. Yeah, that's pretty much all of us. The alternative is to look at what else you can do. Because maybe it doesn't necessarily need to be a castle. Maybe you don't need 38 rooms or 15 bathrooms or, you know, parapets that you can defend things from. Maybe you just need a place to stay. So you look at something on the right. It's a little smaller. It's still kind of nice. You can make this work. You just have to reevaluate what the actual mission is that you're trying to accomplish. This is where the first temptation to take shortcuts comes in, because you still have that golden image in your head. You still have that castle mentality. You want to build something that's yours. Please don't take those shortcuts. This is what happens when you take those shortcuts. Because your project doesn't just necessarily need to talk to your thing. Often you have to integrate. You've got multiple things. Maybe you're talking to AWS. Maybe you have a separate authentication system. Maybe you're trying to make your Linux system talk with Active Directory. You've got some really old thing or schema changes or some third-party software that you're integrating with. And it usually ends up badly. So the other way that this happens is management comes to talk to you and says, hey, by the way, that thing that you're working on, can it also do this? Who here's had feature creep in their career? Okay, the folks that put their hands up, I'm not talking about systemd. Other things. All right. This is where a lot of people end up with the, okay, I need to get the mission done. This has to happen. I have deadlines. Management is breathing down my neck. There's always time to do it quick. There's never time to do it right. And this is the problem. This is what we have to address. And this is why I say it's your fault. We as an industry need to start doing a little better at maybe explaining to management, hey, look, we really can't put this out in public and claim it's condo housing. We're not going to be able to sell this stuff. But that conversation is difficult, especially for folks in the industry. And we're not the only ones doing this. Everyone else in the industry is doing this too. Who's familiar with, if does anybody recognize this image? Just show of hands. No? Okay. One person. This is the Kowloon Walled City in Hong Kong. This city is what happens when every single organization, company, everybody on the internet's all taking the same shortcuts. They're all cheating in kind of the same ways. They're all doing their own thing. There are no standards here because everything is a standard. This is what happens when we all take shortcuts. And we have built this. This is effectively the internet. Everyone's taking shortcuts. Everything is in a constant state of falling apart. And we all think this is acceptable. We've become desensitized to this fact. For those who don't know, this city was basically a center for corruption, drugs, gambling, and all sorts of illicit activities. Completely and totally different from the internet, which is the hub of all sorts of illicit activities. This isn't okay, people. This is what we need to stop. These are the conversations that we need to start having with people. These are the conversations we need to have with our management. And so if we take a step back from this and we start thinking, okay, fine, we've described a hypothetical project. There's some, you know, vague, hand-wavy stuff that we can all kind of relate to. But that's not how this works. There are very specific things that impact each and every one of us. Who here's heard of Knight Capital? Uh-huh. They lost $440 million in under an hour because of a glitch in how they deployed their software. Can we all say unit tests together, people, please? Citigroup, completely accidentally, when they changed over some of their coding standards to expand branch locations, bank acquisitions, things like that, they just straight up forgot to alter their testing. So they didn't report customer, like actual legitimate customer data to the SEC for 15 years. Granted, they found the mistake themselves, but it cost them a pile of cash just because they didn't remember to update their testing. It gets a little further. In 2010, the stock market just straight up completely crashed. There was $1 trillion worth of finance that just got wiped away for roughly 36 minutes. And nobody to this day has a clear fundamental understanding of why, even though we're putting people in jail for this. After the 2010 crash, they started to put rules in place to prevent things like that from happening. So that problem is totally solved, except that it happened again in 2014 because we still haven't learned lessons, and a lot of people treat rules as challenge accepted. You've told me I can't do this. Fine, I'll find a workaround. Our very own Ben Cotton, if people are aware of Ben and have seen him wandering the halls, had a blog post about this because his bank likes to ask for PIN numbers on the website. If your PIN starts with a leading zero, maybe it counts as a digit. Maybe 0123 doesn't need to be 0123. It just happens to be 123. What happens when you try and use a three-digit PIN? You'd think maybe stuff like that might should be caught in testing. Just a little thing. It's not just the finance market. And I really don't want to pick on Samsung here, but my God. The medical industry is being hit by this. There are resource cabinets in hospitals that you basically, doctors walk up, they scan a little thing, your patient data gets applied to it, they grab what they need from the supply cabinet, and they move on. It's automatically attached to your electronic medical record. However, these things are running Windows 2000, Windows XP embedded, they're running these really old systems, and there are security holes everywhere in them. This is a problem because there are little things out there like HIPAA compliance that make this a big deal. When you talk to the vendor, and in this, I'm not specifically naming vendors. However, all of these URLs are legitimate. I will publish these if you feel like, you know, diving into this and drinking and sobbing in your own free time. This particular vendor said, no, we don't sell that thing anymore. It's out of date. We're not going to fix it. The hospitals all need to upgrade. But we're talking about actual facility items. A filing cabinet doesn't go end of life just because you say a filing cabinet goes end of life. There are filing cabinets in offices here that are 10, 15, 20 years old. Why? Because it still works as a filing cabinet. A hospital's not going to life cycle something just because you say they need to. They're going to life cycle it when it stops meeting their needs. As a defense contractor, the next one is just downright hilarious for me, the F-35 and all of the problems that that's been having. Specifically, I'll call this one out because it's amusing to me. Lightweight individuals don't eject from this plane properly. So if you try to eject and you're under 165 pounds, you're hitting the canopy as you go out. That's probably a bit of an issue for the pilots, to the point they just straight up refuse to fly it sometimes. That's one of many bugs that we're talking about. Any San Francisco residents here? Anybody laughing at the bottom bullet? Because that was reasonably recent. I see a couple of thumbs up from the audience. Yeah, that's a special one. These are all things that we've built in because we took shortcuts in the industry. These are all things that we have done to ourselves. And that is why this is not okay. We have not built in or planned for updates, CVEs, even other use cases that we didn't think about. And this is just the stuff that we didn't accidentally, that we didn't plan for intentionally. We're not even talking about the malicious use. We're not talking about people who are actively subverting things on the internet. We're not talking about people who are trying to legitimately slip around rules and regulations. We're just talking about basic, normal, oops, I forgot to do unit testing planning. So the intentional bad behavior. We'll look at something very recent. Who here saw that Fitbit actually bought Pebble? Who here has a Pebble device? Are you worried about updates, perhaps? What's going to happen to it? Anybody starting to... I told you blood pressure and loss of faith in humanity at the beginning of this. Volkswagen and their emissions testing. You know, I'm sorry. Yes, I did not use, I was corrected by a member of the audience. I did not use the air quotes around emissions testing. This isn't to pick on proprietary software. Open source software has a lot of the same problems. It doesn't necessarily change things. However, with proprietary software, it's a little easier to try to hide it because nobody gets to see your secrets. Sometimes you just straight up want to protect your business model. And Sony was famous for doing this back in the early 2000s and late 1990s. Hey, we'll build a rootkit into our music so that nobody can rip CDs. Who's old enough to remember that fun? Uh-huh. These things seem like good ideas to business people. They make sense. If you're a business person and you think, okay, fine, if I can cut manufacturing costs by 10 cents and get away with it, over the course of a year, I make an extra $1 million. My stock price goes up. I get a bonus. This is great. But it's up to us. We're the ones who have to take the hard line and say no. But as sysadmins, as ops, as engineers, we're always under the or we're always given the reputation for saying no, even if it's for a legitimate reason. So that's part of the conversation that we've got to change. If we don't plan for things and we don't have these kinds of changes, we end up like the bottom bullet. IoT in that space is becoming a problem. To the point the largest DOS ever seen, wireless cameras, IoT devices, and it's just going to get worse as more and more smart things come into your house. My wife and I recently bought a new washer and dryer set this year. This dryer has a wireless bridge on it, so I can connect it to my home Wi-Fi so that I can have an app on my phone that will tell me when the load in the dryer is done. Because the buzzer wasn't enough for some reason. I don't understand it, but you can't put an IP address in everything. Now, I call this out specifically because my problem, and I'm not going to mention manufacturer names or anything like that, my problem with this is that device does not get updates, just ever. So now I've got a wireless bridge into my network, into devices that I trust sitting in my house. And if somebody wants to do something malicious, who's going to know? Why is my dryer using a third of my allocated bandwidth because Comcast now restricts me to 1 terabyte or something? I mean, seriously. This is the sort of stuff that we're building for ourselves because we work for the companies that are doing this, and this is what we have to fix. God, I'm sorry. I apologize. Yes, I did throw out a shameless plug for another talk. I'm very much an advocate for security and IoT. And as some of the people in the audience like to point out, the S in IoT stands for security. Thank you very much. It's a terrible dad joke. You're welcome to use that. So what is the solution for all of this? How do we fix this as an industry? What can we do? Because clearly in the last 2 decades of this, we haven't done it for ourselves. What are the options? What can we do about this? How can we make this better? Do we want to go down the road for certification? I don't know about you guys, but my degree is not actually in IT. I don't have a CS degree. I don't have an engineering degree. I don't even have an MIS degree. I'm supposed to be a teacher. My degree is in education. I shouldn't be on stage talking to you people, but for some reason they think I'm qualified, so here I am. I don't think certification is the right way to go because some of the best people in this industry that I know have no formal background in IT. Alice Goldfuss mentioned this in her talk earlier this week. She brought up Kelsey Hightower. Same thing. Everybody dealing with Kubernetes has heard of Kelsey Hightower. He's along the same lines. I trust him as an industry. Okay, that would be if I call him a thought leader, that would be mean, so I'm not going to use that word. However, everybody knows Kelsey. They're aware of what he does. He does good work. Certification's not going to help things. It's just going to cause problems. So what about educational requirements? Do we look at, you know, okay, do we need ethics training? Do we need to go down this road? Do we need to actually sit down and teach engineers the difference between right and wrong? And I don't think that's it either, because every single one of us sitting here knows that this is a problem. We know as we look at other companies, like, why the hell did they do that? Everyone knows this is terrible, but we all have those skeletons in our closet in our own daily lives. We've all done terrible things. I'm sure that at least half the audience here has a few git commit messages or code comments that they're not proud of. Hack, fix me later. Why did I do this? Why does this work? So what is the answer? How do we fix this? Turns out it has to be us. Because if we can't have educational requirements and we can't have certification driving this, it has to be the people on the ground standing up and saying no. We have to do what sysadmins are famous for. We'll say no to people. Except that's not a good conversation to have either, especially in the U.S., because job protection laws in the U.S. aren't exactly our friends here. So when management comes in and they say, do this, we say no, and I'm like, fine, I'll find somebody else. They'll just walk down the line. Sales engineers are great for this. Hey, I need this feature. Can this be done? No. Next engineer. Hey, can this be done? No. They'll just keep moving around the office until they find the programmer or the developer who sits there and says, well, yes, you can do that, but great. I heard yes, we're doing this. I got a customer who will buy it. That's not good. That's not a good place to be. The downside for this is just pointing the finger and saying we need to fix this doesn't really work either, because every single one of us has a different niche environment in what we're doing for IT. Some people are doing big data. Some people are doing embedded devices. Some people are doing smart hub development. Some people are doing random other things with technology that we haven't considered yet. One solution isn't going to fix everything for this. So the downside to this is I don't actually have an answer for how we need to do this. And this is part of why we're all, you know, should be drinking at this talk. But again, it's a little early in the morning, so possibly mimosas. I don't know. We'll see. What do you guys think about this? Am I off base with this? How do you think you can bring this notion of no up to management appropriately? Or how do you want to start having that talk? I've silenced everyone. This is where you guys come up to the mic, answer questions, talk, share your own war stories. Here we go. Yes.
I think part of the problem is there's a disconnect between what we, the sysadmins and developers and ops people, think is important and right, mm-hmm. and what businesses consider to be important and right. Basically, if it affects somebody else's ROI, then they don't care about it, right?
Absolutely.
So we need to find a way to couch all of this and how fixing and stopping all of this and letting us all say no will improve ROI for everybody over time. I don't know how to do that, but I think that's at the root of the problem. So
that's exactly it, because that conversation is very difficult to have with management. As an engineer, if you we'll pick on Pebble again, just because, you know, I can see you sitting here shaking your head about this. If you're an engineer at Pebble and you find out that you've been acquired, how do you go have that conversation for, hey, we can't abandon large tracts of our customers? And Pebble's not the only one that's done this. This happened earlier in the year. It might have been last year. There was a smart hub company called Revolve that was bought by Google and became part of the Nest family. And as soon as that happened, it was immediately killed. They bought it under Revolve, lifetime subscription. Buy this device, you'll never have to worry about it again. We'll keep pushing up. It lasted a year and a half and it's dead now. Thanks. They bricked every single customer they had for that, and there is no recourse for this. So maybe that's an option. Maybe we look at law. Do we have consumer protection laws? Do we have things that help us, apart from tracking children in this country, which is a little creepy all by itself, do we have anything that actually protects users? You can go into your browser, you can click the little do not track me thing, and everybody happily ignores that. And there isn't any real validation for that unless you've got somebody who's competent enough in IT to dig that down and track it. And some people are. Some people enjoy tracking down spammers in their own time. Some people enjoy doing that sort of thing. Personally, I'm not one of those. I've got better things to do. I don't want to have to worry about that. I just want this stuff to work. Does anyone else have feelings on that? Please, by all means.
So, as a parent, my approach to dealing with upper management is like dealing with small children. Need to make them aware of the consequences of their choices. Mm-hmm. And you outline to them, all right, this is what we want. See, look, it's all bright and happy and sunshine and flowers and unicorns and rainbows and everything. And this is what you want to do. And look, it's evil and dark and there's monsters and they'll eat us alive if you make that choice. Mm-hmm. So when you lay it out that way, typically unless you have a super ego on the guy who's making the decision, they will tend to follow the path of lightness and rainbows.
Ego is not something we have to worry about in this industry. None of us get full heads. It's totally fine.
So this is a consideration that's sort of at the far end of the spectrum. And I'm thinking of the situations where you've described where there's much more of an ethical component to the mm-hmm. decision you're being faced with. And this is something I heard in a very different context. So the context was, if you're taking a position in a government that you might not agree with, okay, and you're hoping to be able to effect some change from the inside, one of the things, went the advice, that you need to keep in mind is that you need to be prepared at any moment to drop the letter on your supervisor's desk that says, I quit and I'm not doing this. And so along with that is, like, number one, write out that letter first and have it in your desk. But number two, have the resources so that you can back that up. You've got 6 months' salary in the bank or whatever. All of which is, like I say, it's toward the extreme end of what you're talking about. It's something that I hope I'm never faced with. And it's a lot to ask of people, but it's something to keep in mind.
So there's okay, in the interest of this being recorded and potentially shown without, you know, NC-17 ratings or anything else for this, I believe what you're going for is FU money. Having enough ability and enough self-worth to sit down and just say no.
Yeah.
Large chunks of this industry are not in that position, especially the
Absolutely.
Guys straight out of high school, straight out of college, the early ones who, you know, this is their first rodeo and they're not sure how to ride yet. So there's a lot going on with that, but I do agree. And the other way to look at that is potentially we need something from, you know, to take an example from the medical industry. Let's look at the time from the early days when doctors were basically glorified butchers. We've moved from that now into regulatory bodies, you know, that license doctors to be able to work. But that goes back to certification. Do we want to go down that road as engineers? If we go down that road as engineers, how do we do that? Because there's such a broad spectrum that you cannot paint everyone in this industry with that same brush. So that's where it gets to be a bit of a problem.
Good stuff, good stuff. Certainly I have used fear tactics and threats. These are good tools for your toolbox. At the very base here, this is not an engineering challenge. This is a communication challenge.
Absolutely.
Right? Accountants have a language. Engineers have a language. Boards of directors have a language. You need to develop enough of these communication skills. You need to teach them. I used to have people complain that I couldn't plug their server in today. Mm-hmm. But if I bring them down and show them that it's a 100-amp power cord the size of my leg, they start to understand. And you can leverage that stuff to build this communication. But if you can't really sit down and have this two-way dialogue with these mm-hmm. different people, you're never going to get anywhere.
And there's absolutely a component for where that conversation needs to happen. Part of the issue is that conversation doesn't necessarily scale, because sometimes that conversation has to happen between two companies or two different industries, and a lot of times those engineers aren't allowed to talk to each other. So you end up back in Kowloon City and everybody's kind of relying on the fact that this wall's not quite at 90 degrees and may have got this other angle over here. Building components are totally different. So yes, I agree, it is a communications thing, but talking is hard.
It is. Uh-huh. I've sent about 80% of my engineering staff to Dale Carnegie so far, so I'll recommend that as mm-hmm. as a step forward.
That's it.
I've been fired from one job and quit two on mm-hmm. whistleblowing issues, and it's especially terrifying as an underrepresented person in technology. Mm-hmm. And I think our answer is actually yes, certification, but not through a top-down thing. I think we need to unionize. I think we need to look at banding together and supporting each other and being able to do mass action, because if we are united enough to say none of us will do this, that's not okay, then I think we have a much stronger voice.
Mm-hmm. There is absolutely a critical mass component to this. You are dead on the money with that.
I gave a talk yesterday on surviving environments such as this, when you get told from on high, do this terribly insecure thing you're going to hate yourself for, and just do it anyway. And it leads to the cynical bastard sysadmin, which is a defense against your own sanity again in this hostile environment.
Absolutely.
But in the after comments, we had a nice discussion about ways to do internal advocacy to try to change some behaviors. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the areas that I think we can do some help, we can help here. The one area that we can help here is help illuminate the risk space that the company is occupying. Mm-hmm. And that requires more, that's out of scope for so many of us because we just don't understand the legal implications of doing this sort of thing and can describe it in such a way that the risk managers or the security and compliance teams will realize, hey, you have a point. Mm-hmm. This increases their lawsuit exposure by a large degree because of the way the rules work. And that's one way we can start pushing forward by changing the risk perception of management. And one way we can help with that is what was just said about the collective action option. Mm-hmm. By collectivizing, that increase, that changes the risk scope, not just from you'll get sued by the consumer protection agencies, but you may end up with direct action against you.
Yes.
So that is...
So to that end and to the point of unionizing, it may not be the proper organization, but LOPSA is, mm-hmm. if nothing else, a support group and 12-step program for things along these lines. You can find a sympathetic ear in organizations like LOPSA. So it's not, you know, the full, hey, we're a union, everybody has to have, you know, a card-carrying LOPSA member to work in this industry, but you can at least interact with other people and get pointers for how to have conversations like this. So, mm-hmm. yes. Oh, God, not you.
Sorry. So I'm actually going to try to be a little bit of an optimist. I think there are two things that we're already doing that we need to do more of that are in the right direction. The first is, Jim, you already know that one of my mantras is that good sysadmins shouldn't work for bad companies. And usually that's technical, you know, bad companies that are doing tech wrong. But, you know, Jim and I are both active in an online community, and I probably tell someone to quit their job at least once a week, in all seriousness.
At least, yes.
And the normal response is almost always some variation on imposter syndrome. You know, I can't possibly get another job because I'm not as smart as you guys. Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of great talks at this conference, and a lot of people are tweeting about it and talking about imposter syndrome and trying to find ways to get over it. And I think the more we fight that, the fewer good sysadmins we will be seeing at bad companies, whether that's technically bad or ethically bad. So I think that's something we're already doing, and that's going to help. Mm-hmm. If good sysadmins gravitate to good sites without being held back by imposter syndrome, then efforts to do evil will be hamstrung by a lack of talent. All right, that's great. The other thing is bureaucracy is designed to allow terrible decisions, right? It breaks a really horrible decision up into a lot of tiny defensible decisions. And so the less bureaucracy we have, the harder it is to make bad decisions. Because one individual has to say, well, yes, let's make this phone explode. I think that's a wonderful plan, right? And no one would actually say that. No individual is going to say that. But people can sign off on small bad things when all that's required is their signature, or even if you have a problem with this phone exploding, please reply within 3 days. Otherwise, we're going to ship it. Things like that. But you know, when we talk about DevOps, one of the things we're talking about is destroying bureaucratic boundaries between people.
Yes.
And so the more I think we work to merge our own teams and work with less bureaucratic influence, work with more self-organizing influence, then we can be sort of a beacon to other parts of our own organizations and say, look at how well this works without bureaucracy. Look at how well this works without, you know, sign-off and check-offs and all of these things that split decisions up, but we centralize them into our teams and work efficiently, and you can do that too, and it makes it harder to make bad decisions.
I would counter some of that by saying that thanks to Citizens United, and now that corporations are people, that there's an individual, and the U.S. has done a fantastic job of holding corporations responsible for things like this and not letting them slide. That's not reality. Crap. I'm sorry. I was dreaming when I said that.
So one of the things I've learned is, over the years, you cannot tell our engineers and developers, you cannot just tell them no. That, because then you're a roadblock. You're just an impedance to them moving forward. And so we've learned how to, with truths and facts, convey to them, here's the pain that's involved if we move this new feature or request that you're making. It causes pain on you. It causes pain on the company. Mm-hmm. We can't pivot. And once they get that, they're like, usually 9 times out of 10, they're going to like, oh, crap, we can't do this, guys. We need to find another solution, and we'll work with you. But then you have to keep repeating and being consistent with that as these requests come up. Mm-hmm. And then it gets easier and easier, and there's a very strong trust that builds up from that.
Alice Goldfuss had a very good talk on that as well earlier in the week, basically saying you cannot say no even if you mean no. It's basically let's have the yes, but conversation. So explaining the downsides to that in a way that management or business folks can understand that becomes something critical. And that is challenging because a lot of times they don't want to hear no, or they don't want to hear your reasoning for why that but is even in the sentence, because there's motivation, often financial motivation, in not hearing that. And if I'm going to give you $100 to not hear something I'm saying, and I'm only going to give her $10 for hearing it, one of the two of you is going to listen, and it's not going to be the one who's happy.
And actually, just to follow on to that, the more you can engage them with us, the more there's a feeling that there's engagement to solve the problem, the easier it gets in the long run. But it is hard to get started sometimes. I actually wanted to make a sort of a quasi-contrarian comment. We've been talking a lot about the sort of us versus them, where them is management or marketing or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should forget the us versus us problem, that a lot of us in the community, especially the younger people, just don't have the habit of being careful and doing things thoroughly and not taking shortcuts.
Node.js is legitimate language. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. The fact that there's so few people in the audience here is to some extent an example of that, because the people who are here are probably primarily the people who already know there's a problem, and a lot of people don't even see that there's a problem. Mm-hmm. So whatever we can do to get out to explain to our colleagues that we shouldn't take shortcuts. Here's what goes wrong with taking shortcuts. Here's how much hair you lose from taking shortcuts or from dealing with other people's shortcuts. The more ground we had to stand on to solve the dealing with management problem. Mm-hmm. I have the great good fortune to work in a small group within a very large department, but a small group in a university in the teaching part of the department. And everyone basically gets it. But still, I'm spending a lot of my time right now dealing with half-built, collapsing castles mm-hmm. that were built by people a few years ago, and no one was motivated to do it right then.
So that's the side that I did not touch on in the talk, is here's this pile of crap, please maintain this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was talking about greenfielding entirely new crap you know, will be allowed to fester and die later. So yes, you are absolutely right, and I do need to look at including, here's this pile of trash, please make it look pretty.
Well, I wasn't thinking so much about that as what we can do within our community to at least get everybody within the community on side, even if their management won't cooperate with them, with the notion that we shouldn't be building the stuff like mm-hmm. that. Illustration. As I said, I work on the educational side of our department. I see the state that our computer science undergraduates leave the washroom in. Why do we expect them to write clean code?
Oh, God. Please, no.
Well, that's fun to follow. I think there needs to be something between the carrot and the stick, be it unions, be it some professional code of conduct, because I can go and make a great case, and I can be really nice, and I can point out the rainbows and the evil things, but I always end up likening us to firemen, which is, you know, you want to pay us because you want someone there, but it's very unlikely your house is actually going to catch fire, but you still need us. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of consequences between, by the way, I'm saying no, and here's a lot of good reasons, unless you're actually the person that just got, you know, hijacked the San Francisco communication system. There's not a lot in the middle, and I know it's bad, but unless I can go up to my CEO and say, you were dumb, give me $100, like every single time,
so there was
they don't see the range.
There was a reasonably brutal study that was done, I want to say it was earlier this year, possibly last year, that showed it was more cost effective to just straight up ignore security and deal with the cost of the breach after the fact. And that is fundamentally the wrong answer. Eventually, those costs are going to change position, and it's not going to be pretty when that happens. So you are correct. There needs to be a balance between carrot and stick. But when it's financially, when there's a financial incentive to ignore it, that's what's going to happen the majority of the time. I don't want to sit here and say people are inherently evil, people are inherently good, but apathy is just so easy.
So it all kind of comes down to money, right? So as long as consumers are going to continue to buy these things, mm-hmm. then the company's going to make money. They're not going to care, even if they've shown historically the companies are more than willing to pay X as a penalty when they're getting Y as an initial bed of money that's coming in. So maybe instead of trying to educate each other, mm-hmm. every sysadmin should spend some time educating consumers on some of this. Maybe that feedback, you know, this company's making one that's more secure. This company's making one that's more convenient, but you're going to end up in cyber hell. So maybe that alone will be enough money to enough of change to the money to the company to make a move.
I do agree that education is important. Consumers should know. There's very definitely a
but
line between. No, they absolutely do not. If you equate it to the automotive industry, everybody who drives has a basic understanding that, hey, I need to change my oil periodically. They don't necessarily need to know how to change it. That's why we get paid. But they should at least be aware of the model of the car they're driving at the time. The other side of that is, why should I need to explain to my mother in her 70s why, you know, she needs to care that this home router may not work? She plugs it in, she gets on the internet, everything is great. She shouldn't have to care about the internals of it. And that's our fault for making that aspect of it a problem. I'm a little...
Almost out of time.
All right, fair enough. This is why it's good to do a talk like this, because you can rely on the audience to fill in the gaps. Thank everybody here. Thank you all.